The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's August 28th, 2024, 2:40 in the afternoon. I'm John Williams. Hi, and thanks for joining us. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin. I'm a former journalist, a government reform worker, and political activist, currently working in Michigan and Wisconsin to turn this election in the swing states, doing what I can to challenge
authority.
Okay, I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, political columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the voice of authority at Picayune Sentinel.
I challenge that.
Newsletter. I knew I was setting you up for that, Marge.
You did.
So that's all you're going to say about your little self there, Eric? Just you published the Picayune Sentinel?
Man about town, bon vivant. Fiddle player.
Dilettante, I believe you were also called this week. We'll get to that in a minute.
No, I was called a folk singer.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah. Yeah, I got a response for Dan Proft in my newsletter tomorrow.
Yeah, I would never go to battle on a war of wits and words with Eric Zorn. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, Marge, take care. Nick noted that.
Duly noted. Thank you.
And by the way, Kate Plies is wearing a necktie this week because last week, I believe this may be your reason, you don't normally wear one. You look darling in it, but Austin had a necktie on because he was going to be on Fox News that night with Bret Baier, and so Austin was all buttoned up. What's with the necktie, Kate?
Everyone did really give him a lot of props for that tie, and I guess I was a little jealous, but also I have an amazing tie collection. I don't wear them very often anymore.
Tie. You wear men's neckties sometimes?
Yes, they're wonderful. This is one of my dad's. Isn't it beautiful?
Oh, I like with the tie clasp. Yeah.
Look at those nice colors, the gold and the
blue. Is it monogrammed on the clip too there?
No, that's just it's one of his old clips, but not a very valuable one.
You look like you should be an Annie Hall or something like that with the tie on. It's a nice look.
Why, thank you. I got a detention in high school, actually, for wearing the tie because it violated our Catholic school uniform.
Austin looked and sounded really good on Bret Baier, by the way, if anyone saw that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he sure did.
I did. I'll reserve judgment for maybe when Austin gets here, but they went to him to talk about how bad taxes are in Illinois. Taxes are bad in Illinois. There are some good things about Illinois, and some of them are about taxes. And I don't know if it's incumbent upon the questioner or the questionee to say, however, but they never got to what's good about Illinois. I mean, I don't know that I would describe it as a hit piece, but it was, hey, what can we say bad about Illinois relative to taxes? And Austin delivered the goods because he knows the goods, but he didn't feel like he should paint both sides of that fence. And so I have to mention that to him.
You know, obviously he had no control over what questions Bret Baier asked or what Bret Baier would include in the final piece. He could have said some wonderful things that were never included.
that's possible. Although we'll ask Austin because I'll bet he didn't.
On the cutting room floor. Yeah, I don't think so either. Well, the Illinois Policy Institute, I love Austin. I have a lot of respect for him and his work. I don't agree with all their positions on taxation and good government, but they do make some good points, I have to say.
Nothing he said was not true. I mean, everything he said was true.
Right. It just needs to be more balanced. I agree with you, John.
So, we did train our communications clients that if you don't get the question you want, answer briefly and then pivot over to say the thing you want to say. And I feel like if he wanted to say more positive things, he knows how to do that.
Austin didn't want to. And I think he'll own that when we visit with him. The Democratic National Convention has left the building. Last Wednesday at this time, we were holding our breath, hoping the city gets out unscathed. And we were marveling at the energy and oratory skills of some of the speakers. Now that all is said and done, I give the city, the police, and the party an A. Eric gave it an A- on the radio with us this week and then took a little heat from some of our listeners for the minus mark. I'll get back to you on that, Eric, in a minute. But Marge, how did you score the overall performance of the city and the Democratic National Committee planners?
I give them an A. I think they played the expectations game pretty smartly, I think. I mean, they promised to pull it off smoothly, and they more than did that. I think Chicago looked terrific throughout the convention. It was good publicity for us, as I think I said last week, and we didn't have to endure a NASCAR race in order to get it. Not that it wasn't inconvenient in various ways. Speaking of inconvenience, there are many of us who left the convention with COVID, but mostly.
Yeah, you sound great, by the way. Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, I'm negative as of yesterday, so mostly through it, thank you. But it's hardly a super spreader event, which I think is also a positive indication. I mean, certainly there are cases. There are 26,000 people there, so you'd have to have half of them to be super spreader, and certainly that did not happen. But I think it went smoothly. The police handled protests in a smart and non-combative way, which was critical to put 68 to rest, which I think they did. I think the worst encounters that I saw were Thursday. I don't think it got a lot of press, but on the way out of the arena, we were all blocked from leaving by protesters. Police were there. Capitol Police were there. The Capitol Police were pretty awesome, by the way.
Yeah.
Very professional. And they guided us to a place where we could wait until they cleared protesters so we could continue down the street. And then every couple of blocks, there are more police telling us which way to go to be safe. It was very smooth, and as we saw, very few arrests.
Yeah, when I heard 68, I thought that's a good day, with or without 50,000 conventioneers in town in this city. How about you, Kate?
Well, I mean, of course, it's two different things. How did the DNC run the inside convention, and how did the city run the outside? And I'm going to give an A to both, and I absolutely understand your point, Eric, about the DNC really should have been capable of making people speak much more concisely, like half the time for each of their speakers. And they should have had the capacity to schedule the speakers so that the main people came on during prime time. That they absolutely should have been able to do that. But I'm still going to give them an A, because if you're grading them on what the whole point of the convention was in reality, which was for the DNC as an organization to present itself as well as it could and to totally promote its candidate in the best possible way, they absolutely did that on every possible metric by making the whole thing a really terrific fun show. And Kamala Harris did a wonderful job delivering her speech. So if that's how you judge it, then it's definitely an A.
How about Mr. A-?
Well, I gave it an A- for the thing that Kate talked about, which was the fact that they did not get their main speakers speaking primarily in the 7 to 10 o'clock block, which is prime time. That a lot of the people were, the most important speakers were speaking after 10 o'clock, which is after 11 on the East Coast, which was not necessarily good scheduling. I also marked them down, and we're probably going to get some pushback on this panel for this, but I think they should have let somebody from the uncommitted movement have a speaking slot on Thursday night, last night of the convention. They had 51 or 52 slots in that evening program. They could have shortened one or just added one more. These were people who were registering objection to the Biden-Harris administration's handling of the war in Gaza. And a lot of the rhetoric in this convention was about listening to the other side and being moderate and a big tent kind of thing. And I don't think it would have killed them to have had somebody come up there and speak out, make the case that the pro-Palestinian protesters were making. Maybe they could have done it with a video so the person didn't go off script. But you had 13.2% of the voters in the Democratic primary in Michigan earlier this year vote uncommitted, and that was largely to register objection to the way the war in Gaza was going. You had 600,000 voters, more 600,000 more voters in other primaries voting for uncommitted. And so you have a faction of the Democratic Party, and it could be a pivotal faction that wants to feel included in this. And the speech that the pro-Palestinian people had prepared did include an endorsement of the Harris-Walz ticket. So I think it was a mistake to keep them off politically. It doesn't matter where you come down on this issue, but I think politically it was a mistake to shut them out, and that's why I gave them an A-. Otherwise, the city looked great. I thought the police did a really, really good job. 74 arrests and no major injuries to police or protesters. That's stunningly good considering what we were afraid of. So
Kamala Harris did acknowledge the desire for Palestinians to have a safe and sovereign state, but that may be the only recollection I have of any mention of them or any sympathy to their plight.
Well, given that, what I say, like there was a group of delegates who were there who were part of this uncommitted caucus, and how many 700,000 plus voters who voted uncommitted in the primaries in order to register their feelings about this. You're going to need those votes. You're going to need every last vote in some of these states. And to make them those people feel included without necessarily endorsing what they had to say. Say, well, look, we know this is part of the Democratic Party. It's got people who are very, very concerned about this, and they want it addressed in ways that it's not being addressed. I don't think every speech in a convention has to be a pep rally necessarily. I think it can be a discussion of important issues, and it can be welcoming people inside this tent that you're forming.
I disagree. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have. You thought I would.
Challenging authority.
Yours, but not theirs. But there's no guaranteeing what would happen in the arena. So you could have somebody on video and they wouldn't have liked that because it's sort of insulting to say, we don't trust you. I don't think that would have worked out. But if you had a speaker, and I did look at the speech, you had provided a link in the Picayune this week and I read through it, and the speech itself was not harmful. I thought it was a fair speech, but you don't know what would happen in the arena. As it is, there were disruptions from time to time of people shouting Free Palestine. There was the woman who wrapped herself in a banner pretending it was her dress, I guess, and was led into the arena, and then she unfurled it and started screaming her slogans. These protesters are very in your face. I don't think it serves their cause very well. That Thursday night, as I described us leaving, we weren't allowed to walk to the train because we'd passed Union Park where demonstrators were throwing water bottles and other things at delegates and those of us trying to get to the train. So, they're not afraid to hurt their own cause with an attack that they think gets attention. And I think it was too big a risk. There are other ways to address the concerns. One being what Kamala Harris said in her speech, which was very strongly worded and un-Biden-like, in my opinion. So she's moving herself to the left from Biden. And beyond that, they can have a meeting. They can have an event. She could do a town hall. There are a lot of things she could do. I don't think I'd do a town hall, but I would do a private meeting with the
delegate.
You wouldn't
even do a town hall.
On that topic, I don't think I would. She's on a trajectory, and the DNC was a carefully planned, although reorganized in just a couple short weeks, a carefully planned trajectory that built excitement for the people in the arena who really need to get out and do the work and make sure we elect this team.
Marge, what's the topic that you think she should not do a town hall on? I said a town hall. You said not on that topic. What topic?
Oh, on Gaza, on the Palestinian.
Sure, but I mean, what's the worst thing that would happen if she sat down and did a listening tour with some pro-Palestinians, assuming that this is a reasonable voice representing the people and not Hamas or violence?
As Eric has said, I think several times, there's such diversity among the protest group, and there are many who are the way you describe, and there are many who are not. And I think it's challenging to figure out, but not impossible.
But you're running from it then.
I mean, no, I don't think she should run from it, but it did not belong as a speech in the DNC.
Yeah.
And my opinion. But I think I totally agree.
I agree with you, Marge. I challenge Eric's authority, even though it's not usually my job to challenge authority. I will challenge you.
I'm not sure Eric's an authority anyway, but go ahead.
Wait a minute. I accept the challenge, but not the challenge to my title.
I'll challenge a little bit there too. The point of the DNC was to be a political event. I personally didn't want to just see a feel good political show, but that's just me. I would like to have just actually heard more real policy and that sort of thing, but that's not what its purpose was. It wasn't all about me. It was about them. That's what they were going for. And
they want to win the election, right, Kate?
I think that's what made sense for them to do.
You don't think that there was an upside to letting the Palestinians speak, who not only do Palestinians
really
in America, but let me just ask that question.
Right.
But not only would that population in the United States maybe favor that, but there's a lot of young people who would be energized by hearing their opinion validated on the floor.
That could very well be. We'll never really know for sure which way would have been
sure.
better for them. But I mean, I read the speech that the Georgia state representative, I think, was, you know, hoping to read. It was pretty low key. It never even mentions Hamas. It doesn't mention October 7th. It's like the Gaza war just magically started because Israel wanted to bomb Palestinians. That in itself would be offensive to a lot of people. It's unclear to me whether they truly did promise that they would not deviate from that script, because I've seen it a couple of different ways and I don't know who's correct. But I would understand if the DNC didn't believe that they wouldn't deviate from the script, because as Marge, as you were pointing out, it is a movement that has shown itself in many, many instances to be okay with doing offensive things that don't seem to really do a lot for their cause. So I would understand if the DNC didn't want to take that chance on national television.
They could have done it in the 5:30 hour. What time did things get started? Like at 5:30? I mean, much earlier than prime time, much earlier than the network coverage. You could have given them a really early speaking slot. And mm-hmm. I've covered conventions, and I know that there are many times during the day where delegates are milling around and people are speaking. It's like those speeches that people in Congress give, where there's like they're seen up there thundering on, and then you pan to the seats, you realize that nobody's actually
there.
Listening to them. They're just talking for the video. So I think it could have been done. I mean, and my disagreement on this only has to do with whether I think it was smart politically. The issue Hamas, I mean, that's a good point that Kate raises. I don't disagree with much of what Marge says either, but I just think that if you want to get the most votes out of this, that would have been the way to do it. But, you know, we'll never know if I'm wrong, right?
Right.
That's the beauty of being a pundit. But I think if they'd have done it during the day, it wouldn't have been an empty room. Every media outlet in the country and internationally would be in the room to record it.
Or you would have watched it the next day.
It would still be a forum for whoever wanted to act out while she was speaking. I just don't see a way where it could have been done that was safe for the DNC. But I do hope that Harris and Walz will follow up and address this issue in a more personal way.
And you have to stress that if you're interested in ending what's going on in Palestine, ending that war, if you vote for Donald Trump, thinking that you're going to show the Democrats and you're seriously concerned about the Palestinian people, you're nuts, because Trump is not a friend to the Palestinian people at all. And so if you're going to vote strategically, then they'll get behind Harris and Walz and then they'll work with that administration down the line.
Speaking of Tim Walz, Tim Walz's son Gus, 17, reacted quite emotionally to his father's speech at the DNC. "That's my dad," he said. He was in tears, cheering and pointing up at the podium. At a glance, in a second, you could tell that this was a sincere, loving reaction by a young man with some sort of disability, which we've since seen described as anxiety disorder, ADHD, and that Gus has a nonverbal learning disorder. add that to neurodivergent for phrases we're catching up on. Some seized on the display and criticized it. The Daily Beast reported that Wisconsin radio host Jay Weber said, "Sorry, but this is embarrassing for both the father and son. If the Walzes represent today's American man, this country is screwed. Meet my son, Gus. He's a blubbering bitch boy. His mother and I are very proud," Weber said. He later deleted the tweet and apologized for his quote-unquote stupid and hurtful remarks. And notably here in Chicago, radio host Dan Proft mocked Gus Walz. "What's the deal with Walz's kid?" Proft asked. "Can somebody get Gus Walz some Ritalin?" He played cuts from Saturday Night Live to parody Walz. He said the kid was weird. Proft has since been removed from a nonprofit disability advocacy group that he was on, and his co-host Amy Jacobson has since resigned her position as a Chicago Public High School volleyball coach.
But she's still on WIND radio.
You know, I don't know that she should lose her job for that, because that's what they do over there. It's a hate radio station. It was a hateful remark. You know, the funny thing is, though, for all of these people who say that I'm going to take down my tweet or I'm going to apologize because I didn't know that that kid had some sort of disabilities, misses the mark. I don't think he was fair game if he didn't have a disability. He didn't ask for his dad to run for president, vice president. I mean, 17 is still kind of a vulnerable age. It's not 12, but he's not Hunter Biden, for crying out loud. He's not Don Jr. He's a 17-year-old kid who was in tears because he loves and was so proud of his dad. What about that didn't you get? Why is that worthy of mockery?
That's exactly right. And, you know, ridiculing any child for showing that kind of emotion is just bullying. And Proft is punching down. Somebody put it on Twitter. They said, "Being proud of your dad is normal. Crying is normal. Being so proud of your dad that you cry is aspirational," which I thought was a wonderful way of putting it. That, you know, on top of the fact that this kid fairly obviously had some disabilities that he was mocking, I am going to take the unpopular position that Amy Jacobson was just kind of a getting along sidekick here, as Proft was driving the bus here, as he does on that.
And
on
that's
that radio
true.
Show.
That's what they're showing.
And she was kind of, she did a little imitation of him saying, "That's my dad." She didn't really say much. And I think that what should have happened here is that she should have not lost her job at Amundsen High School coaching volleyball, but they should have encouraged her or made it a condition of her continued employment that she speak to the entire student body about how wrong it is to make fun of people for their differences, and also how wrong it is not to call other people out on it when they're doing that. Like, what she should have said, "Well, wait a second." While Proft is going on, she should have said, wait a second, you know, this is inappropriate. We don't know what's up with this kid, and he's just a kid. He's the kid of a politician. We don't pick on them. But you need to stand up to bullies when they're bullying other people too. And I think that would have been a better outcome than just banishing her from the school and saying she's unfit to coach volleyball. I mean, you know, I understand that she played along and she shouldn't have, and I hope no one thinks that I support her politics or anything like that. But that's where I come down on it.
Assuming that she would have accepted that requirement, that would have been a wonderful way to do it.
For all we know, they suggested it, and that's why she resigned, because she didn't want to do it. I mean, I'm making that up, obviously. I have no idea what the terms were that led her to resign, except that parents were very vocal about wanting her out. They didn't want their kids working with her.
You know, it looks bad. I mean, it looks as bad as Proft being on an advocacy group for people with disabilities, and he defended his participation on that board afterwards. He said, "I gave thousands of dollars to them. I raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. They kicked me off because I'm conservative and they're a bunch of liberals," and he positioned it as that. But I'm interested in what you all think about their employment. Do you all think that they should get to keep their jobs as broadcasters? And do you think Amy Jacobson should lose her job at the high school? And I don't know that, well, I heard from you, Eric, about the radio jobs.
I'm not a cancel person necessarily. I think that to cancel somebody, an offense has to be really egregious to the point of being like just way beyond the pale. I think this was pretty awful, what Dan Prof said, certainly. I thought it was really, really not cool that Amy Jacobson kind of laughed along with him, but it is their audience and it is their, you know, their radio station gets to make that decision. And I don't necessarily cotton to this, to canceling people for stuff that they say, even though, I mean, this is hardly the worst thing I think that Dan Prof has ever said.
Well,
I mean,
I'm trying to imagine their shock and dismay when they found out, oh, the kid was reacting that way because of these emotional issues that he has. Like, they didn't see that. That wasn't apparent. They couldn't Google it before they said it or posted it. It would have been a few strokes. You would have.
I was watching it. We were all watching it, right? You could tell right away. You say something of that kid. He's got issues. But it was sweet, man. I was choked up looking at that. That was a wonderful moment. So, you know, I'm not a cancel person. My vote is no, not to lose their radio jobs.
I would go with Eric on that. I too, not a cancel culture person, and I would think that both Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson did realize that they were wrong to have said what they did, even though Dan Proft is mad about getting kicked off that board. He knows he shouldn't have said that. I'm sure WIND doesn't have to. I'm sure Dan Proft's audience is just fine with it because that's what he does. But WIND, I would hope, would think about doing on air basically what you, Eric, suggested that Amy Jacobson should be doing over at Evanston High School. They should have a show or at least a nice long segment where they talk to some disability people, meet with some experts who work with kids like Gus Walls, and talk about it in order to educate their audience a little bit. That would be the way, I think, to handle it.
Just to clarify, it's Amundsen High School on the northwest side.
Sorry.
Not Evanston High School.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
I was in the arena and they showed Gus on the Jumbotron and I could see him. I was across from him. I did not readily pick up on anything involving a disability of any kind or a neurodivergent condition, but I found it very touching. It made me and everyone I was sitting with start to cry. It was super sweet. And I think, John, you made the point that I would like to double down on at the beginning. This isn't just about, you know, be nice to people with disabilities. He's a child whose father is doing some pretty awesome stuff at the moment in an arena of 26,000 people, and he was pretty excited to see him. I would hope my children react to me the same way were I in that position. And Proft has no awareness about that. His quote is, "I'm not a guy who would make fun of somebody with a learning disability or some sort of developmental condition. It was not intentional. I should probably have investigated it, known to exercise restraint, and I didn't, so I apologize." I think he's missing the point. I just don't think that ridiculing children, whether they're children of politicians or otherwise, is ever an acceptable thing for an adult.
Back in 2016, and actually all the way through Trump's term, there were a lot of anti-MAGA people who made a lot of nasty cracks about Barron Trump.
Wait,
and that
really
was completely wrong also.
I don't.
Oh, absolutely. Lots of nasty cracks about Barron Trump.
I do not think in the popular culture you heard much criticism. I don't think you to this day hear mockery of the president's son, the former president's son. Am I missing something there?
In social media, you didn't hear
that one, but I believe there was. And I'm pretty sure that people like Dan Proft would have been critical of it at the time. These kids should not be brought into these political battles.
Right. And I still remember Rush Limbaugh calling Chelsea Clinton the White House dog. I mean, it was just, I mean, that kind of stuff is just so far beyond the pale. But, you know, this actually feeds into something, John, as a radio personality, you probably, since you're like ad-libbing a lot of the time, I'm sure that in the course of your career, you said some things that you regret. And you need to give people a little bit of grace. I'm not talking necessarily about Proft here so much as I am Amy Jacobson, who I think it just follows along in the slipstream of whatever Proft is spewing. But you know, I'm doing a series. I'm hoping to have it be a series in the Picayune Sentinel, and Kate and Marge are willing to participate in this too, and so are you, John. I'm calling it Regrettables, and I'm leading it off tomorrow. I'm republishing a column that I wrote that I really regret, and that is really one of the stupidest columns I ever wrote.
Do we get to pick?
Going to vote this? No, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for that response from you. He's like, how could you pick just one all the columns you wrote? And you know, the truth is that if I don't get more people participating, I'm going to have to go back into my archives, and it's not going to be too hard to find things, because we all say things that are. You know, wrong-headed.
Yeah.
And I just think,
I clarify, Eric, do you mean you want us to go back through your stuff and find your worst mistakes?
No, I want you to find you. Kate, you wrote a bunch of columns. Marge, you've written some stuff. John, if you have some memories of those.
Oh, God, yes. To tell on ourselves. Wow.
We came out exactly. Yeah.
It's a higher wire, I think, for those of us in live media, because.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. You know, even in the podcast format, we can say, go back and cut that out. I didn't mean it.
You do that a lot. And then I leave it in whenever you say that, by the way. I don't know if you picked up on that.
Good to know.
Yeah, memo to self. Be careful.
Right.
But that is the thing. And I think that a lot of what came out of Dan Proft's mouth was on brand. You know, that's kind of the sort of stuff he does, and that's the way she plays along. It would have been remarkable if Amy had stood up to him, because that's just not how that show goes. And he's very smug and confident and conservative and mean, and that works. There's a radio audience for that. So it's not the kind of radio I want to do or listen to, but I listen to it often enough to know that show. I listen to all the radio stations in town. I'm with you guys. I don't think you should cancel people. This is a commercial market, and they can live and die by their own sword. So that's their thing. If I was on the board of a charitable organization and what he said ran against our values, looks bad to keep him on, too. I mean, maybe it looks bad to kick him off because he'll say you're playing politics, but I think it looks bad to keep somebody who says that something that hurtful, ignorantly or otherwise, to the very people you are trying to help. And I think Amundsen probably did the right thing too, in at least accepting Amy Jacobson's resignation. If she wants to do an assembly, maybe she still could or should. I'm not worried about canceling her part-time job, but I hate to see people lose their income.
Right. I know that if anything, Prof's relationship with the board of Envision was something that was costing him money, that he was raising money for them and donating money to them. He's not losing a paying gig.
Right.
So this is, I don't consider that the same sort of thing. If they want to dissociate themselves from someone, that is not nearly the same thing as canceling somebody.
I don't want to see the conversation end without making the point that what we've all skirted around is, yeah, there are radio stations here and across the country who make their money by being hateful. And thanks, Trump. He's changed the national dialogue. Not that it wasn't.
Thanks,
already.
Rush Limbaugh. That's Rush Limbaugh.
I was going to say, thanks. Yeah.
Started there, but Trump made it worse. I mean, he did it himself. He stands as a president and a presidential candidate and mocks people. That's the highest possible profile for hate.
Anyone who realizes that it was Serge Kovalevsky, is that how you say his name, the New York Times reporter, the disabled New York Times reporter, that Trump mocked him from the stage. He was mocking some sort of motions with his arms. At the time, he was a candidate. He was the president of the United States mocking a disabled person. And so this kind of pales in comparison to that. I mean, I think.
We're in a rabbit hole now. Limbaugh was describing activist women as feminazis before Donald Trump had a TV show, and that got great traction. I think there's an audience for that. I know how you feel about
Rush Limbaugh. Didn't come out of nowhere. Before him, we had Howard Miller here in Chicago.
We do. I want to wrap up this part of the conversation, but I also want to say, though, that then when is it fair? Because the Trump kids have been pilloried, excluding Barron. I mean, we talked about him, but the adult children of Donald Trump have been mocked a lot. And I suppose we would say that's fair game, right? So when do you decide how somebody has crossed the line from mockable to not mockable?
When they engage themselves in politics, when they become like Eric and Don Jr., who speak for their father, who advocate positions, Ivanka.
She was involved right off the bat also.
Right. And but Tiffany was just a law student. And I don't think she I mean, maybe lately she's said some stuff, but Tiffany and Barron were not involved in the arena. And I would say that they hands off to those, to their kids, unless they put themselves forward in some ways to take advantage of their father's position.
I think the needle's moving on Tiffany, but it
may be. Yeah. But at the time when, during his presidency, she was just a law student, I think, or a college student.
Yeah.
Just leave her alone.
I agree. They inject themselves and they're quick with a quip about Democrats. Anyone from Nancy Pelosi to Kamala Harris, mostly women, somehow they like to attack. And when they do that, you can hit back.
Okay, we'll pick it up here in a minute. But first, give me half a minute to remind you that Ottawa, Illinois is the middle of everywhere. Enjoy all the boating and biking and hiking in Ottawa's fresh outdoor spaces. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, everything from established hotels to luxury resorts to private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your trip today at visitottawail.com. This message brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Now, back to the Mincing Rascals. What about the debate rules? I'm a little surprised that this debate about the debate is becoming a thing. I hope and expect that they'll debate. I think Kamala Harris has every obligation to the American people to debate. And if she can't get the rules she wants, I think she needs to compromise to make sure that we see her engaged with Donald Trump on a stage. I think that's really important. And I'm not talking about theatrics necessarily. So the issues of muted mics, audience, the only hill I would die on is audience. I won't do it in front of an audience. And I don't know that that's been resolved. Everything is about muted mics, notes, fact-checking stuff like that, the network, the commentators, all the usual stuff. But to me, the one that is most critical is, do you have a live audience there?
I think it's Trump who's objecting to muting the mic now, even though Biden wanted to mute Trump's mic because he found his constant banter distracting. I mean, in his big NBC interview, he said that's when he kind of lost control of the debate last time, which was horrible to hear, in my opinion, because he couldn't put his own thoughts together with Trump talking next to him. That seemed like a low bar, and that was a big concern to me. But at any rate, that's why they were doing it the first time. And now Harris sees a benefit to let people hear his outbursts, let him see that he can't control himself. And his handlers are saying, oops, he can't control himself. Don't let anyone see or hear that.
So now they want the mics muted. The tables are turned.
It's Trump, right? So everything keeps changing all the time. But my understanding is that while Trump, I think on Sunday, did vaguely sort of threaten to think about not doing the debate at all by saying that ABC wasn't fair to him, so why should he go there? Then he came back and said, yes, he would do it. But then Harris's people said that they wanted the mics on, and the Trump people still want them muted, which is what was
the original rules. Yeah.
So then they just, you know, tossed some insults back and forth at each other. I haven't heard anything definitive, and everyone can correct me about anyone actually really saying that they'll walk out.
I do think it's fair for the Harris campaign to negotiate their own rules. Why should they have to accept what was good for Biden? As I gave in that example, it's a different dynamic with her on stage, and she has different requests and different priorities.
Well, she'd like to let Donald Trump hang himself, but if that doesn't happen, she still commands her own mic time, right? She is responsible for his words. He's responsible for his words. And if he's not able to spill over into her talk and defeat himself, I don't think she should ask for the favor that presents. Ask for it. But if you don't get it, it's not like anybody's denying you your opportunity to speak, Kamala Harris. Talk. Tell us what your answer to the question is. Debate the man.
I think that they should negotiate their own debate. Mm-hmm. I do think this was an accommodation for Biden because he couldn't think clearly if Trump was still talking. And Trump knew that. And so he kept badgering while Biden was speaking. That's what he did to attack Biden. But you couldn't hear him. We couldn't hear him, but Biden could hear him. I'm not sure it was a good idea for Biden to even ask for that. Nonetheless, it was his accommodation. She doesn't need. She's saying she can handle it. Let him just keep going. But make sure everybody else hears what Trump is doing. Mm-hmm. And that sounds fair to me.
To start off, the Democrats were saying, hey, you agreed to these debates with Biden. Now you have to keep to the schedule you agreed to, even though it's a different candidate. So if you're going to say, hey, you have to stick to everything we agreed on, it's not really fair play to then turn around and say, well, actually, we do want to renegotiate. If they want to renegotiate, then Trump also has a right to renegotiate whatever he wants to renegotiate. And maybe he doesn't want to do it on ABC anymore. So how come, why would he not have the right to say that if she can ask for changes herself?
Yeah, in principle, I think that the muted mics is a good idea, that candidates interrupting each other. I've moderated a few political debates in my time, nothing major like this. And candidates talking over one another, interrupting each other is really annoying. On the other hand, it's also revealing. I think that Trump's blustering and his rudeness is something that Harris wants to underscore. But once you agreed to those rules, once the Democrats agreed to those rules with Trump, for them to say we're going to change them now, I hope that they do, because I think I think Harris is right to want that. I mean, she's a political advantage in it. I don't like the idea of live audiences at debates of this magnitude either. They're fine for aldermanic debates or for mayoral debates, but you don't want them playing to the audience. You want them playing to the mass of voters, who are watching or listening to the debate. And live audiences just distort that sentiment quite a bit.
I don't blame Kamala Harris for wanting the open mics. She'd obviously like Trump to reveal himself just as he did in the interviews at the National Association of Black Journalists convention, right? Every time he opens his mouth, he reveals things about himself. So I don't blame her for wanting that. But on the other hand, I do find it annoying to hear people talk over each other. So
remember in the debate with Hillary where he was roaming the stage, that circular platform, kind of looming and loping around her, and I seem to remember that they had live mics then too, and that played to his advantage in a way. You know, maybe the table is set differently now, so that if he's to be boorish or bullyish, maybe among the undecided voters, that would actually work against him. But it didn't hurt him in the debate against Hillary, if I can equate those things.
I think you're right. I think the moderator should have stopped that. Somebody should have called it out, and it would not have been to his advantage. I'd like to see him try that while Kamala Harris is speaking, because she will shut him down, I'm sure.
But also the dynamic I'm hearing, Marge, is that if this white man is telling this black woman to be quiet or not giving her due, that in and of itself is bad politics.
Oh, yeah. And I saw some registration numbers this morning, which I wish I remembered, but I can't quote them. But there have been something like 200,000 new voters registered across the country since the convention, or since during and since, and it seems like a very high percentage of them are black women and young voters.
Well, and what was the number of the dollars raised? The dollars raised since the announcement, did I see $586 million since Kamala was announced and since the DNC started? It's a staggering sum of money, which I don't know, if you want Kamala Harris to win, maybe it's easy to fall in love with those numbers, but dollars don't vote. But clearly people are putting their money where their mouth is, where their hopes are. It's a lot of money that has been thrown at the DA.
It's a crazy amount of money. Citizens United has done a lot of damage to the election.
Yeah, I don't think any of that's
machinery.
Good, by the way.
No.
I do want to caution any excited Democrats out there, which would include me in some ways, not to put too much stake in this debate, that these debates can often not go the way you think they're going to go. And I don't mean like the Biden calamity, but I just mean that Trump has a way of blustering his way through things and making it difficult. And I know Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor. She's very fast on her feet. you just never know how these things are going to go. And to think that this is going to be a big turning point or that Trump's going to be humiliated, I wouldn't get your hopes up for that. These debates are not really designed for total humiliation.
Except in Biden's case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do think that Harris-Walz are on a trajectory. They need to keep this going as momentum, not just a honeymoon or sugar period or whatever it is Johnson was calling it.
Sugar high.
Yeah. So, they need to keep this trajectory going right through November. So what they need out of this debate is more momentum. They don't need a slam dunk. They don't need Trump to end up under the table necessarily, but they need her to be strong as a contrast to the last debate, which is pretty low bar.
That is a low bar. Right. Kate,
there's a euphemism.
Something. I think what you said a moment ago is just a good message overall that Democrats need to not be complacent just because they put on such a great show. It was a show. She was already on a very small upward trajectory above Trump, which had pretty much leveled out at the time of the convention. And now she's getting a little bit of a bump, right? She's not out of the margin of error. I mean, people are not saying she's absolutely going to win. I think his
not
latest.
In Georgia.
No, exactly. Yeah. His latest number, I think she had like 50. Let's see, electoral college probability of winning is 51.5% for Harris, 48.3% right now for Trump, according to the Nate Silver computer model, which is obviously not, you know, the all-seeing, all-definitely knowing model, but, you know, it's a decent thing to go by anyway. It could change at any time. Look how many times this campaign has completely flipped
around. Yeah, that's true.
Well, yes. And there are several things to look at. One is that I think 4 years ago at this time, Joe Biden had a bigger margin over Trump than Harris now has. And he just eked that out. I think 8 years ago at this time, Hillary Clinton was seen as a lock to win the election. And then you go back to Michael Dukakis, who after the Democratic convention in, what was it, 1988? When was that? Gosh, years ago. 88, I'm pretty sure it was. Dukakis had like a 17-point lead in the polls and ended up getting trounced. So no one should be complacent at this point. And I think Democrats did get complacent in 2016. I know Hillary Clinton didn't campaign in some of the battleground states. Wisconsin. And they got to run through the tape, as they say in track, on this election. They cannot take this for granted, no matter what the polls are telling them.
Yeah, Kate's right. I think who knows what the next black swan is. This has just had been one unexpected and large event after another. And I do think that, however, this debate, if there's only one, plays out, will be maybe not determinative, but it will be crucial how this debate plays out. And if I just may offer one last observation about that, the optics, though, of Kamala Harris talking down or interrupting Donald Trump might not play well with the swath of America, too. Here's this black woman who isn't giving this man the respect he deserves. Or something like that might play out in some people's heads. I think they would both need to be cautious about how they interact with each other if their microphones were open the whole time.
That's a good point. He is a former president, as much as none of us like to remember. He is a former president. And about half the country voted for him and maybe, yes, could be offended if they feel like he's being really disrespected by Harris during the debate. That's a good point.
Well, she should not, and I think would not, accept any kind of a convoluted standard for a black woman.
I think that's what I'm alluding to. I think I am alluding to that. I'm just saying that I think some of that is out there.
Yeah, but is it among the undecideds or just among his base?
I don't know.
I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, yeah. One last thing. Erica always likes to talk about how bad these Chicago White Sox are. And he's been keeping a fantasy bracket, a division, if you will, of the worst teams ever in baseball.
I'm calling us the No-No Sox as a play on, remember the Go-Go Sox?
Sure.
Everyone was excited about the White Sox. And I'm comparing them to the 1962 New York Mets, who lost 120 games and set the modern record for losses in a season, the Detroit Tigers of 2003, who lost 119 games, and then the 1916 Philadelphia A's, now the Oakland Athletics, who set the record for the worst record, winning-loss record in history, modern history, which states from the beginning of the 1900s, which is .235 winning percentage. And right now, the Sox are right at the line of the 1916 A's of being the worst team since 1900. And they are seriously on pace to lose more than 120 games. It'll be, depending on how they do today, they're playing a doubleheader on Wednesday, and that'll be mostly done by the time this podcast posts. But it could be that they are going to have to play .357 baseball at the and right now they're caught in the .230s. They're going to have to play that well toward the end of the season in order not to lose 120 games. One of the issues and the asterisk that I like to put on this is that the Mets lost 120 game. They lost 120 games and won 40 games. That's only 160. They had two rainouts that didn't get made up because they were so bad nobody cared. But if they had played those two other rainouts, the odds are pretty good that they would have lost both of them, and they should have been credited with 122 losses for that season.
Given the benefit of the doubt,
get there.
Yeah.
I mean, they at least one, right? I mean, that so they should have had more. So the White Sox may end up playing an extra two games, and they may just barely beat that record. But I just think it's interesting. I mean, there's nothing else really interesting going on. The Cubs are just over 500. They're 6.5 games out of the wild card. So the Cubs aren't very interesting. And just how bad the White Sox are is kind of interesting. If you don't bleed White Sox black or whatever the expression would be, it's just really interesting to watch a really, really bad team race toward this incredible, awful record.
It's enough to make you want to go to the South Side and cheer them on for a game or two.
Fear for them to lose?
Yeah, I used to say that, Marge, because I thought there's some novelty to that. But now it just must be such a miserable line of work to every day go out and be humiliated on a national stage, to be known for your futility, that I want to Pat, even though they're all rich and young and have great futures, I suppose, but what a lousy existence for a very long season. I actually think I would be cheering now and encouraging them, you know, play good baseball.
This sort of reminds me, it's been a long time since I've played those card games, hearts or spades, I think either way, where you shoot the moon, like if you have a handful of bad cards and you're like, I cannot get a good hand, and then you decide, I want all bad cards, you could shoot the moon. That's sort of what they're doing now, right? Trying to shoot the moon. If we can't win, we might as well just, I mean, they're not throwing their games. They can't seem to help it, but that's like the goal now. Let's just shoot the moon.
Yeah, right.
I don't think that's their goal at all. In football, you know, it really pays off in big time to lose at the end of the season, to have a bad record so you get the first draft choice. Mm-hmm. Basketball, it helps some also to have a really bad record, to lose games at the end of the year. Baseball, the baseball draft, they're drafting really young prospects, and sometimes they really turn out, and sometimes, you know, a 10th round player will end up being a superstar. It's much more chancy in baseball because these high school phenoms, sometimes they pan out, sometimes they don't. So being really, really bad doesn't really have the same kind of payoff in baseball that it does in other sports. But I just, you know, as a fan, as a sports fan, I just think it's really interesting to watch. And I'm sure there are going to be some interesting books written about if they do make this mark, the worst team, what it was like all year when they changed managers. And they've got this star pitcher who they're going to be shutting him down because they want to preserve his arm for trade bait, because they're going to have to rebuild this team from the bottom up. And it's just more interesting than if they were just kind of mediocre. The fact that they're spectacularly bad is fascinating to me.
You really think there's going to be a book, The Boys of the Summer of 2024?
I am sure of it. There's a book about the 62 Mets. I forget what it's called, something like Can Anybody Here Play This Game? Something like that. I mean, there are definitely books about really, really bad teams.
The Sox are about to break a long-standing Major League Baseball record. So it only makes sense that we are actually discussing the possibility of giving them a couple of $100 million to hand in Bridgeport after keeping hundreds of acres idle in parking lots for to make money off of them, and then relocate instead to the South Loop, where they will create the vibrant little community around the park that they could have done in Bridgeport 20 years ago. Yeah, sure, we should do that.
I think cheering them on. We went to a collegiate baseball game in Kalamazoo at Michigan League when we were on vacation this summer. And apparently they had a doubleheader. Something got rained out, so they played one game earlier in the day, and the game that we had tickets for was either, and you couldn't quite get a straight answer, either the B team or they were just exhausted. And in the end, I think the score was 13-4. It was just sad to watch. You just felt so bad for them.
They're getting paid good money to play a game. I don't feel sorry for these players. And they don't have any loyalty. None of these people have any loyalty to the team. Just offer them a little bit more money and they'll change cities in a heartbeat.
So the teams don't have any loyalty to the players.
By the way, there is the book is called Can't Anybody Here Play This Game by Jimmy Breslin, and it's about the 62 Mets.
Oh, well, so it's by Jimmy Breslin. All right.
Okay,
he could write about anything. But I also think that the book about the White Sox will not just be about the physical inability of the players, but the psychology. That's what I'm interested in, when that sort of cloud hangs over players or employees, how it dooms everybody. It's sort of like the whole is less than the sum of the parts. Those are all professional baseball players. There's something almost anomalous about how badly they're all playing. They should just by chance be winning more of those games. What did Andy Mazur say to us, Pete? The number of games that they were winning after, I think, the seventh inning, it's over 40 of the games that they lost this year. They were winning more than half of the game and then ended up losing. This team just collapses. That's the kind of groupthink that I think a book about the White Sox would tackle, and I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. What is it like? And of course, they're aware of this record. They claim not to be. And some of these stories I read in the papers from the columnists, they say like, oh, you know, we're not focused on that. We're just focused on winning every day. But you know, in the back of their minds, they are looking at the number of games left.
How are we going to lose now?
And how are we going to lose now? They got 30 games left, and they've lost. I don't know. We don't know right now, but they've lost 101 or 103 games already. So they are on pace to set a record in it. And, you know, I would read a book by that.
Well, it does give us a chance on the radio. We say, okay, what's going to be a larger number today, White Sox losses or the temperature? Because we've been about 100 degrees, and the White Sox are about 100 losses. So that killed 5 minutes on the radio. And that's all the time we have for the podcast this week. Marge Halperin and Kate Plies and Eric Zorn. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
All right, that was fun. That was really fun, guys.
Ladies sound good. March, if that's COVID, you seem to be weathering the storm pretty well, huh?
Yeah.
I had checked out for a good 24 hours, which I might have done after the DNC anyway. And I still have some congestion. But like I said, I've been negative the last 2 days, so I don't think I'm going to test anymore.
All right, campers. We'll do it again next week.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, ladies.
Bye.
Thanks, gentlemen.
See you soon.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.